Welcome. Have you, people, do they come on Thursday and Friday? You guys having a good time?
Yay!
All right. Yay, good. Well, welcome to the first AA workshop of the day. The topic this morning, I'm Kathy Showers, I'm an alcoholic, by the way. The first topic this morning from 10 to 11:15 is going to be for making amends. And you have four moderators. We're not going to bother with doing readings and all that because we just want to hear from them. They all would love, we're going to leave plenty of time for questions and answers. There's usually never a long list of questions where it comes to amends. No two are alike. And so we will ask at that point. I'll come back up once they've done their 10 minutes. We have a microphone set up so that Mike can get that on the tape. Otherwise, we don't hear anything, the question out here from the audience. So if you know you'd like to ask one, probably a good thing at that point to kind of move over there and we can kind of form a line. And we'll try to get to as many as that we can before about 11, yeah, 10. So your moderators today is going to be our Thursday speaker, Jim T. from Athens. We've also got the Friday speaker, Jerry W. from Apex. Both of them have done a great job so far. The tonight speaker is going to be Carl from Covina, California. And the spiritual speaker on Sunday is my friend Amanda. Amanda B. from Alabama. Can't you see the halo? It's awesome. So without further ado, each of the speakers is going to come up. I'll let them kind of decide what order. Whoever picked the short straw, I guess, will start. And they'll come up here to the mic and do about 10 minutes each on amends and their experience with amends. And then, like I said, we'll open up for questions at the end of that session. So without further ado, I'm going to give it over to the moderators. Have at it.
My name is Jim Turner, and I'm an alcoholic. So we're talking about amends here, and but I want to preface that first. My newest best friend, Jerry, and I were chatting a little earlier, and I told you guys Thursday night that I work in a treatment center. And I get them from 6 weeks to 2 years. And so I'm not a counselor per se. The closest I come to counseling is every now and then I'll go, well, how does that make you feel? We basically talk about how they're progressing with the steps. And you may find this hard to believe, but not everyone who's a client in a treatment center practices a program of rigorous honesty. So I ask them what step they're on, and I ask them how they're doing, you know, how their sponsor's having them do it. And I've learned some really interesting stuff. I was under the impression, wrongly, that most sponsors work out of the big book, that they did it like my sponsor did it with me, and I do with the guys I sponsor. That's just not true. I've found that there are as many different ways to sponsor as there are sponsors, which is fine. I've also found that there's some interesting stuff going on out there that I was not aware of. I'm a firm believer in two things, my experience and what it says in our literature. We've been hard at this for 83 years, and it's been working very, very well. To the point of, I believe it's safe to say that Alcoholics Anonymous, although not the only way to get sober, punch a cop, you'll get sober, right, has had greater success than any other method in the history of alcohol, right? So this is what I see. There seems to be a movement away from the literature. I hear things like, well, my sponsor says it should take 2 years to work the steps. And I'm thinking, if I'm a cancer patient and the doctor tells me we're not really going to be able to finish treating your disease for 2 years, I'm finding a new doctor, you know. And there's just some stuff going on. Jerry mentioned networks. There seems to be this belief out there that if I have a network and I send a gratitude list via text every day, I'm fine. And I just, that just makes no sense to me. Maybe I'm old-fashioned. I don't know. I know that recovery from alcoholism for me was based in the 12 steps. And all of this other stuff. I mean, the people, that my clients will say, oh, have you tried this new spiritual app on your phone? And I'm like, no. Because somebody with 2 months of sobriety tells me they found the greatest thing ever. I run like hell from that. I think that making amends, you know, if we look at AA history, Dr. Bob, when he and Bill first met and they ended up developing the early stages of the AA program, Dr. Bob bought into everything except for step 9. And we all know what happened when he went to the AMA convention in Atlantic City and came back and they poured him off the train. You know, he was just blotto drunk. And so what happened was the next day is that, as y'all know, that Bill gave him a few beers to steady his hands so he could do that surgery. And then he didn't come home. And Bill and Ann Smith were, where is he? And what they found out about 7 o'clock when he finally got home was he was going around Akron and he was making his amends. And he never drank again after that. That was it for him. And so to me, what that says is if one of our co-founders needed to make amends before they found permanent sobriety, it must be somewhat important. And for those of y'all that heard me speak on Thursday night, you know that my sponsor basically said, this is not an apology. The step doesn't say made direct apologies. It says made direct amends. And when we amend the Constitution, what do? We change it. Amends are about a change. There seems to be this idea out there that if I don't do much work, I'm going to be okay. I hear a lot of this, don't drink and go to meetings, which is fine at first. It works great right up until the point we drank. Don't drink and go to meetings is the same thing as saying don't drink no matter what. The problem I have is I drink no matter what. That's not going to work for me. We may as well just get Nancy Reagan to come in and say, just say no. That doesn't work. There's a complete psychic change that has to occur from the steps. That's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work, in my experience. The 9th step amends to me if done properly, done thoroughly. Give me a sense of freedom like nothing I've ever known in my life before. It's about going to people and not saying I'm sorry. My sponsor told me they really know how sorry you are, Jim. You don't have to tell them that. But to say I'm wrong, that takes great humility. And my 9th step amends was my first foray into humility. I had to look humility up in the dictionary. I didn't know what the hell it was. I thought it had to do with humiliation. The definition of humility that I like the best says to become teachable. That makes sense to me. I can wrap my head around that. If you look in the 12 and 12 and you read all 12 steps, the word humility shows up in 8 of them, and it is described in the other 4. So we're looking, I think, to gain humility as we go through the steps. Having to say I'm wrong gives me the ability to gain a little bit of humility. And I'll tell you one thing about the amends. I don't like to make amends. It's embarrassing because it means I'm wrong. And I do not like to be wrong. The effect that the amends had on me was they actually will get me to change my behavior on the front side so that I avoid putting myself in a position to make amends. And to me, that's part of the change that had to occur coming into recovery. Every guy that I've ever sponsored has either disappeared or stayed sober. And sometimes when they disappear, involves relapse most of the time. And I can draw a very fine line as to which ones make it and which ones don't. And the simple fact is, the ones that make their amends stay sober. The ones that don't or half-ass it don't stay sober. To me, steps 4 through 9 is where most all of the change occurred for me. And I think that the amends process, making amends freaks people out. In today's society, they do not understand this concept of making amends because they have a tendency to go, oh, you don't need to say anything about that. In which case, I tell them, oh, yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. Because this is not for them as much as it is for me. Now, if the relationship becomes healed, fantastic. But I needed to get free. I needed to get free. The steps teach me to have a relationship, a healthy one with myself, with my higher power, and with everybody else. And as Earl would say, nobody else to play with. So this is about me setting things right with everybody else, because I had screwed it up. As an alcoholic, I do a number of things very poorly. Relationships is always in the top two. And so I need to learn how to repair that. And I need to learn how to have healthy relationships. And that comes from the amends process. Thank y'all.
Jerry Weaver, alcoholic.
Hey, Jerry.
Good to be here this morning. Jim, thank you. He mentioned that story about Dr. Bob. I always, when he was talking about this, I've always been struck by how simple those guys kept things. And the interesting thing about that is, so our birth date, Dr. Bob's sobriety date, is actually the same day he drank. So, yeah, so if your sobriety date is the day after you drink, you got an extra day you can add to you if you follow Dr. Bob's logic. But he actually drank the same day that he made amends to folks. And when you read some of those stories about some of the pioneers of AA, or those early guys, I mean, it was really just a simple process. Man, Steve, I borrowed a watch from Steve, my friend there. It's got pawn shop qualities to it. Starts with an R and ends with an X. It's not fake. Just how simple it was. I mean, they basically, you know, gave their life to God, did a confession, and then their next job was to go make restitution and make amends. And I was brought into it similar to that. I mean, when I got sober and worked the steps the first time, I mean, I was flat out told that if you want to stay sober, you're going to have to make amends, that you can't keep looking over your shoulder. And I was a guy that was, I mean, I was afraid of everything, and I probably thought there were more people out to get me than there actually were. But I was living, at the time I got sober, I was living in a small town, and I was afraid to go to the post office. I was afraid to go to the grocery store. I was afraid to kind of go out during the day because, you know, I was ducking and dodging people and didn't want to have anything to really do with anybody. And you know, I owed a lot of money and had hurt a lot of, you know, family members and friends. And, you know, from my perspective, there just seemed like there was no way ever to get out of all that. There was no way that those relationships were ever going to be healed, and that I was ever going to pay all the money back, and it just seemed insurmountable. And you know, I thank God for good sponsorship and good, you know, members of AA that you know, showed me the right way to do stuff. And I was not given a break or let off the hook on making amends. I mean, I was told, hey, if you've harmed people, then you owe them. And that you need to clear this up, and that you'll never be completely free until you do that. And that, you know, things that are left undone, they're like boat anchors. They prevent you from moving on to something better. They prevent you from moving on to a better life. And And for me, the eighth step in Alcoholics Anonymous is probably overlooked quite a bit. I mean, there's actually a step that says make a list and become willing. And we, in AA, a lot of places, we give a lot of power to step 4 and 5. Well, 8 and 9 were way harder for me than 4 and 5. The process of becoming willing to make some of those amends was not real easy. And but I did, you know, very, very early in my sobriety, you know, I did turn myself in for stuff I'd done. I did go and make arrangements. You know, nowadays everybody wants to, well, let's save up the money and then go pile, you know, the whole pile on people. And I was taught not to do that. I mean, I didn't have any money when I got sober, but I was told to go talk to people and face them and acknowledge what you did and make the best arrangements that you can. And you know, and that's what I did. And I, as I said last night, you know, everybody I've ever gone to make an amends to like that, where I was just honest and open, they always were willing to work with me. And, you know, one of my financial amends, it took me 10 years to pay the money back. I gave them money every month for 10 years. And I was taught that's, you know, that's what you do to, if you want to get better. And I, you know, I went and talked to family members, and I started to become, now, if you'd asked me when I first got sober, I thought my amends list was basically the phone book. I guess we don't have phone books anymore, right? I mean, that's just how self-centered I was. I've harmed everybody. And, you know, and because of good sponsorship, I was able to whittle that list down to an actual legitimate list. But I had an experience. Jump forward here. I was sober, I guess, about 7 years. And a guy, some of y'all know Don Pritz, he had moved to North Carolina. And some of us were hanging out with him, and we had done some book studies together. And I'd heard him talk about some of the amends that he had made. And I realized that a couple of the amends that I had made to some family members were weak at best. And it was one of those deals where when you first get sober and you go to talk to some of these people, they're kind of like what Jim said. They're, oh, man, we're just glad you're sober, and that it's great. Just keep it up. And I had a kind of a similar experience to that with my mom. And I realized that I had done, I mean, after I made the initial amends when I first got sober, I think the most important thing is how do you act after that? And how do you live after that? And are you living an amended life? But I felt like I'd never had a really, I guess, detailed discussion with her. So I took her out to lunch one day and told her I needed to talk to her. And I told her, I was like, you know, it must have been really, you know, difficult for you raising me and all the trouble that I put you through and all the, you know, the times that you had to, you know, come get me out of trouble and you didn't know where I was at. And the one suicide attempt, you know, she's the one that found me. And it was interesting. When I got done, I asked her if she had, you know, if she wanted to say anything, which I had kind of learned that from Don, that you should, once you say something, you should just kind of shut up and let them talk and ask them what you can do to make it right. And she'd been waiting for the conversation. yeah, she'd been waiting. And she just started talking a little bit about how, you know, how she felt when they came and handcuffed me in the high school and took me out for assault with a deadly weapon, and she, you know, her having to come down there and get me out of jail, and all the times that she'd gotten calls from people about things I'd done, and all the times where I just kind of disappeared, nobody could find me, and just how she felt about all that. And she told me a story about, and I, at that point, I didn't know anything about this, that I was in a blackout up in that town, that small town we lived in, and I guess I was called in the scene up at one of the convenience stores, and somebody had called her, and she came up there to get me, and I guess I basically kind of beat her up, and I didn't know anything about it. And no one had ever said anything to me about it. But, you know, she told me how she felt about that and some of the, you know, just some of the things that had gone on. And so I, when she got done, and she wasn't being very, I mean, mean. She was just kind of matter of fact about the conversation. And so I asked her. I was like, "Well, I mean, is there anything I can do to correct that or to make that right?" And her answer was interesting. She basically said that, hey, the way that you've been living the last 6 or 7 years is amends enough, and that what she really wanted me to do was just to continue to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and try to help other people. And it hit me that when she said that, I mean, you know, an alcoholic destroys lives, right? I mean, we an alcoholic will destroy, you know, hundreds of lives, or, you know, and the inverse of that is a recovered alcoholic who's trying to live the program as best as they can impact hundreds of lives positively. And that my, you know, my membership in AA and the way that I had was trying to live, she saw that, and she knew that I was trying to do things different, and she knew that Alcoholics Anonymous is what made the difference. And I saw her actually become, that day that we were sitting there talking, I saw her become free because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, in a real way, the amends is for us, but it's also for the other person. She's off the hook. She's not at home right now worried about what I'm doing right now. She knows where I'm at, and she knows what I'm doing. And so the amends actually help her to become free. And she's not burdened anymore by, you know, the life that I'm living. And so I took that. And she also told me she wanted me to stay involved in AA, so I don't have any choice. I mean, my amends now is I got to continue to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and try to help other people. And that's not a bad deal. And I do think that for me, it's, you know, amends is sometimes the discussion can be the easy part. What am I going to do afterwards? Am I going to live an amended life? Am I really going to try to not repeat those behaviors that I was doing? And am I really going to try to serve God and to serve other people and believe that love and tolerance is my code and try to be of maximum service to other people, like it talks about in the ninth step. So I'll tell you something. I'll tell you a funny story. Now, I made an amends to a guy one time. I was convinced that I had stolen from this guy. And I sweated this amends bad. It was just mostly from embarrassment. It was just embarrassing to go talk to the guy. Well, I called him up and went to go meet with him. I laid out, you know, this time that I'd, you know, broken into his trailer and stole this. It was money or jewelry or something like that. He looked at me and he says, "Man, you got the wrong guy, man." They said that. He swears to this day that never happened. I either got something screwed up or I'm making stuff up. That's one of them times where, well, okay, good, I can keep that money then. But, you know, I've also, there's lots of stuff that I've done, you know, stealing and robbing and stuff when I was drinking that I don't remember. You know, I've been taught ways to give money back, and I've been taught ways to volunteer in the community and just to give back to society that I took from and try to make amends that way. There's lots of ways to give back and to try to correct things that I've done wrong. I'll share one story. I'll sit down here. And I don't mean this to be morbid, but this is what AA gave me. When me and Steve were trying to get here on Thursday, when we were on the plane and we were taking off, there were some, you could tell there were some people on the plane that were nervous about taking off during the thunderstorm, and they were talking about all this lightning and all that. And as we were taking off, the thought hit me, well, what would happen if the plane just crashed right now? And I know that you probably shouldn't think like that, or that's kind of morbid, but and But it did hit me that what would happen, if we got struck by lightning or the plane just went down and everybody died. And here's the thing. I was actually okay with that. Everything was in order. I had no unfinished business with anybody. And all my stuff is taken care of. And that's a tremendous sense of freedom from a guy that was scared to death and was afraid to go to the post office when he got sober. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that freedom through the taking those actions of those first nine steps and having that spiritual awakening. So thank you.
Morning, my name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I was listening to Jerry's story about being on the plane and being okay with it going down. I'm on airplanes a lot, and I sometimes start chatting with the person next to you. And one time a fellow said, I have finally reached the point where if the plane goes down, I realize, and I'm okay, that it's my time to go. And I thought, but I'm sitting next to you. It might not be my time to go, for God's sake. And I thought it would have been a perfect time for Jerry to make amends for throwing us all under the bus last night. You heard that. Goodness sakes. Anyway, so, and the bald guys, too. Anyway, I'm just going to talk about stuff that I did and some stuff that came back at me and learning about in the amends process and some practical real-world stuff that actually benefited me. I got sober in the Navy. My first 2 years in the Navy was jails and hospitals and people running around trying to fix things that I was breaking. And my second 2 years in the Navy was simply meetings and so really, taxpayer dollars was not well spent on me being in the military. However, my first sponsor was a guy on my ship. Right? And one of the things that I had done in the last 7 months of my drinking was that I had, they called me an electrician. And it's not really that I was one, they called me an electrician. I'm actually scared of electricity. And so, in the last 7 months of my drinking, it had reached a point where there's these things you do in the Navy where you actually have to go and, as an electrician, you have to tag off whole circuits, go in and take readings, replace breakers, do all of what they call PMS, planned maintenance services. Right? And this is how they keep everything going on the ship. And the last 7 months of my drinking, it had gotten to a point where I was either so hungover or I had to get off the ship to go drink, one of those two things. That really was the status of my life. I would go and block off a whole set of circuits, sign my name to the work that I had done, and go sleep. And then come back and untag it and go back to central control and say, done. So by the time I got sober, half that ship had not, the maintenance had not been done. Now, this was in the mid-80s, the peak of the Cold War. Our squadron would have been, what we did was we guarded the west coast of the United States. There'd be 7 or 8 destroyers that would chase down Russian submarines and make sure they could not come within 200 miles. And this was our mission. So you can imagine, right, if there ever was an emergency situation, and all of a sudden the weapons have to come up, and right, all of a sudden, because of Carl, everything goes. But I didn't think it was that big of a deal. My first, right, I'm just signing my name to stuff fraudulently. My first sponsor, who was also in the Navy, thought this was a big deal. And so my first 2 years of sobriety, when we would come back to the ship after meetings, almost every night, I would have to go back and work about 3 hours to go back and check all the work that I had signed my name to. And this was not digital. This was, I had to go into old logbooks, see what I had signed my name to, go get that slip, that card, and go back again to go redo what had been done. Now, of course, in the military, they do a final evaluation, and then you get this piece of paper that follows you the rest of your life. It's called a DD-214. I At the time, I could have cared less, really. I got to tell you, I didn't really understand the gravity of what that would be. But I was doing it because my first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about that ninth step and that I had to do this and I had to clean this all up. And I got a very, very, the command always changes. So my superiors that knew me drinking were no longer my superiors when I got sober. So my final evaluation on that DD214 was really very complimentary. And that's what follows me around the rest of my life. I think it's kind of a joke, really. So the real world application, that probably would have been the end. But when I got out of the Navy, another amend was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree back when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. I think I got about 10 credits in 4 years while my parents were sending a check to a university. So I had to go back and get what they had paid for in the first place. Right? I either had to pay them back every single nickel or I had to go back and get what they had paid for in the first place. When I got out of the Navy, I found this university that was near this town called Covina, and I'm still there 30 years later. But I had to work. I had to be self-supporting. And so I was going to school, and I was literally trying to make $50 enough for gas for my little VW that I had to push start and cigarettes. That's what I was trying to... Oh, and D-sized batteries for the boombox that sat in... So I could listen to speakers cassettes, right? So I could listen to AA cassettes on, right? And the batteries were expensive. So that's what I was trying to make money for, about 50 bucks a week. And I was working at this construction site for a while, and this guy, man, it was, you know... I had to clean up after the stuff he was doing. He was one of these guys that you could see the crack of his butt. You'd see it all day long. And I'm having to pick up after him, and I'm resentful, and I'm angry. Making minimum wage. But I'm showing up at school every single day. Showing up every single day, and I'll go do this for and trying to make enough money just for gas and cigarettes and D-sized batteries. This one day in class... a fellow came in and he said, "I'm graduating this year in exactly the program you're in, and I've been working for General Electric Information Services for the last 3 years while in the university." And this was 1991, before the internet was even there. And GE Information Services was really the backbone of the internet. And what my degree was going to be in was telecommunications management, which would have been giving me the perfect degree to go in and work for all the big companies that became the monsters of the internet. He said, "I'm graduating and they are going to replace me and they want to hire another person right out of the same university. If you get down there by 1 o'clock, they're interviewing." And I'm thinking, well, I don't have a chance, but I'll give it a shot. So I puttered down in my little VW, had some speaker going on in the boom box. And I get down there. There's about 40 people in line to interview for this spot. And it was going to be, I think, $28 an hour in 1991, which would be like getting a $50 an hour job now. This would have changed my life. And I'm sitting there, and I'm going to be about the ninth person to interview, and kids are going in and coming out, going in and coming out. And then I go in, and the fellow behind the desk is holding my resume that I'd made earlier that day. Of course, my resume has those like 10-year blank spots that says, "So where were you between Cub Scouts and now?" It's that kind of resume, right? But there was the DD214 attached to it. And he looked at that and he asked me just two simple little, I don't even remember the questions, but he just, because of the DD214, he set it down and he pushed the button for the reception and said, "You can tell everybody else to go home. We found our man." Like, and I had no idea earlier, those years of every single night, going back to clean that up, what that was going to, that there was going to be a moment in time where it was going to be the thing that, which way is my life going to go? Amends have worked that way a lot in my life. Another interesting thing about amends, it happened probably in 1997 or 8. It was one of your speakers from next year. And I were sitting having coffee at this coffee shop in West Los Angeles after the meeting. It was before Starbucks was even really all over the place. It was this thing called Lulu's Coffee Shop, and everybody from West LA meetings would come there. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden this woman walked by, and I'm going to change names. Susie, come here, he says. And Susie walks over, he goes, you know that thing that I told you about Fred, you know that story? And she goes, oh, that was an ugly story. Oh, man, whoo, man, Fred is in trouble. And he goes, stop, it wasn't true. I heard it from, and I repeated it, and I it wasn't true. And she goes, oh, no. And he goes, you need to not tell that to anybody else, and I need another favor from you. And this is the part that shocked me. He goes, I need to know who you told. I have to go to them also. And then afterwards, I asked him, he goes, I'm going to go 3 deep with this. I'm going to be busy for 90 days in trying to find out who told who, because it really was a story that could damage a person's reputation. And then he encouraged her to do the same, to go 3 deep with whoever she told. And I got to tell you, I quit gossiping after that. Because I like to golf, and that would get in the way. Yeah. I'm sure nobody in Atlanta in AA gossips. One last little thing. Here's one that when I finally realized the gravity of what I had done, I didn't know what to do. And I still don't have it, and I wish I had a solid answer today to tell you what to do. But it kind of falls under the same category as what Jerry was talking about. When I was 19, now I'm a drunk, but I always financed it by selling pot. And right, and I'm a bad pot dealer because I'm drunk all the time, right? And so we lived in Seattle back then, and there's this thing called the 520 Bridge that connects Bellevue with Seattle. And probably about 100,000 or more people every morning come across the 520 Bridge to get into Seattle. 4:35 in the morning, I'm driving my what I call throwaway car. It is a $200 car that is registered to nobody, that you can just leave at the scene of wherever if you need to. You know, when things get tough, leave. And leave it there, and right, it's not traced to you. Well, I had a trunk load of pot, and there were some other friends driving behind. And I was drunk, and I was trying to, probably listening to some Led Zeppelin on the 8-track. It was probably cassette by then, right? 8-track was way earlier than that. And I'm trying to spark, you know, I've got a beer between my legs, and I'm trying to spark up a joint. And, right? And it was wet, like it always is in Seattle, and the axle snapped, and I completely spun out, and the car just came to a giant stop. And the other car pulls up. We take everything out of the trunk. We throw it in there, and we take off. And we leave this car there. Now, unregistered, nobody there, bridge. They had to cordon off the whole bridge because did somebody commit suicide? Was there a murder involved? Where's the people involved with this unregistered car? They shut down the bridge until 10 a.m. that morning. At least 100, maybe 200,000 people are blocked from getting into Seattle that morning. Now, I got to tell you, later that day, we're just, what a morning, right? Glad we got away from that. You know, that's the way we think. I got to tell you, later on, sober, I started to realize what I had actually done. In that 100,000 people that were blocked that morning, do you suppose there was some man desperately trying to get across that bridge to get to an interview for a job so he could feed his family and he did not make it? It's not likely, it's probable. Do you suppose in that 100,000 people, do you think there was a young woman desperately trying to get across that bridge that morning because her father was dying in Swedish hospital on the other side of that bridge and she didn't make it to say goodbye? That's not only likely, it's probable that something of that nature happened that morning because of what I did. How do you make up for that? How? And as I told you, I don't have a solid answer except for, and it fell under the same category. When Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do something inconvenient, I don't get the luxury of saying, you know, gosh, I'd really rather do that. No, it's yes. It's yes. And I have no idea whether the scales of of this type of stuff, how that works or where it's at, you know, in the karma of life, who knows? One thing, if there are some young people in here, the first thing I want to explain, when Jerry said phone book, that would be the contacts app on your phone. But if you're a young man, I'm not giving advice to young women or women at all. I've learned my life is much better when I don't give advice to women. I have no idea what you need to do at all in any shape or form. But with young men, here's some advice. Right off the bat, if you don't know where to start with your amends, you start with your mother. And you owe your mother three things. First thing you owe your mother is the money. That includes like the deductible on the insurance for the wrecked car. That includes the interest on the bail money. You owe her everything. Next thing, and Jerry definitely touched on this. We owe our mothers to live a life in a way that she can get a good night's sleep. That's because she knows exactly where you're at and that you're sober and you're checking in with her enough that she knows that today, not last week, today. So that when the sirens go off in the middle of the night, she does not sit straight up wondering, is that him? Third thing, I owe my mother to live my life in a way that when her friends ask how I'm doing, she has something to say. She can actually respond to that question. Have a good morning. Thank you.
It hadn't moved. This is the pawn shop watch. Thank you, Steve. Let me borrow your watch. Appreciate that. Hey, family, my name is Amanda Brown. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Amen. By the grace of God, I'm sober today. Wonderful to be with y'all on this Saturday morning. It's a little weird doing workshops before y'all have actually got to hear our story. That we have heard wonderful things already this morning from Jim and Jerry and Carl, and I've been over here taking notes. I hope you have too. I really encourage you, if you have a question about and you haven't heard it shared, please be prepared to stand up to the microphone and ask. Because we each could do an hour and a half workshop by ourselves on this subject. And we've got 10 minutes. So we're only pulling out what the God of our experience is bringing to our heart. So if you've got a question, please don't be shy to come up to the microphone and ask about that. Wow, amends. Where do you even start? You know, when I first got sober, I had 3 jobs in 2 counties and no car. Trying to make back financial amends. One of the biggest financial amends I had was I was in treatment for 60 days on a psych ward in a hospital down there in Mobile. And my mother had collected all the official-looking documents out of my mailbox that all said federal government. Because part of my disease was that when I would come to somewhere, one of the ways that I would like to feel better was as long as there was checks in my checkbook, it never occurred to me that there might not be money in that account to back up those checks. So I was writing hot checks all over Tuscaloosa County and some parts of Mississippi because I'd have to cross the line to get my booze. So every check in Tuscaloosa County over $200 is a felony. So while I was in treatment, they had discovered that my mother had went back and paid all those bad checks. And so when I came out of treatment and we had a contract and she was going to allow me to live with her, and part of that contract was I had to pay that $10,000 back. And if I didn't pay that $10,000 back, she had already made arrangements with Julia Tutwiler Prison, which is the women's prison that's not far from where I live today, and I would have to go and finish the time served based on that money. And the minimum amount of time I was looking at in Julia Tutwiler was 15 years. And that would be with good behavior. Needless to say, I'm motivated. I'm working my butt off in 3 counties That's, yeah, two counties, three different jobs, and no car, trying to pay that money back, right? At about 8 years sober, I'm still paying that money back. I mean, because we're broke, you know, and we're trying to live, and I'm trying to pay rent, and I'd never paid rent before, and I'm trying to be self-supported, and I'm trying to eat and doing everything that my sponsor was telling me to do. Around 8 years, I was getting a little nervous because I had not been able to finish it, you know, and I needed to finish that. I needed to get that off my plate, and I was at Area Assembly, which is, you know, all the groups come together, and they're in Montgomery, and the service positions all come together. Don't y'all have that over here? Don't y'all go to Macon? Okay, same thing. And so that morning, a bunch of us were at Waffle House, and we're having breakfast, and I had a little bitty Toyota Tercel, a little two-door car at the time. And we're all leaving Waffle House, and we're going back to the Madison downtown where the assembly is, and we're kind of on a hill at a red light, and there's this big power construction, big truck in front of me, right? And we're on a hill, and my car is a stick, and apparently his truck is a stick, because when that light turned green, he let off the clutch, and he rolled back over me. Terrible wreck, but I was okay. You know, a little bit of whiplash. Couldn't get out of my car. You know, all the people in the Waffle House, all my AA peeps came out and were helping me. Well, I don't believe that God caused that wreck, but I do believe that the God of my experience can use anything for his good, right? Well, so that wreck happened. We have to get a lawyer. I'm having to go see a chiropractor, seeing the doctor, and they determined that it's that truck's fault. Well, yeah, it's his fault. I mean, he let off the clutch. He rolled over me. He didn't even see me. I was so little, he didn't even see me in his side mirrors. So the lawyers get involved, and they are at fault, and so they start paying the bills. And so one day the lawyer calls me in his office, and I'm like, well, what's this all about? And he said, well, we have finally settled your case. I never had to go to court or anything. He just did all the work. He was one of us. Thank you, Lord, for lawyers in AA. And so he said, here. And he handed me an envelope. And I said, oh, my God, what is this? And he said, well, we've settled your case, and they put a little bit on. I've already taken my cut out of it, and they put a little bit on top for pain and suffering. And I said, what? And so I opened up the envelope, and to the penny, that check was the amount left that I owed my mother for that $10,000. So what I learned from that experience is if I am willing to keep doing what I'm being asked to do, if I keep working my program to the best of my ability, the God of my experience is going to help me. The God of my experience sees the intentions of my heart. You know, I will tell you, the amends process for me was a good experience. That was one of the times where I absolutely got closer to the God of my experience. Look, if you make an amend and you're not praying and you're not talking to your sponsor, I mean, my sponsor would sit there and literally write out the scripts for me to say. And I did have to write the wrongs. It was not, I'm sorry. I am wrong. And I don't know where this came from, but it does not say my part. It says, where was I to blame? Because part implies percentages. That means that maybe I'm only guilty 20% and you're guilty 80%. No, ma'am. It says, where was I to blame? And I had to make those direct amends. And I had to sit across from those people. And my grandmother, God bless her, my Meemaw, who helped raise me, when I had that conversation with her, you know, because there were times... My family didn't know that I was drinking. I hid a lot of that from them. I was young. I got him in when I was 19. So they really had no clue until all of a sudden I'm in treatment and I start telling them the things that I had been doing, right? But she knew little things like I would take money out of her purse. And she knew that I would disappear and say that I would come home and not come home. In the last 100 days of my drinking, nobody knew where I was. And they didn't know if I was alive or dead. So when I'm having that conversation with my Meemaw, I'm talking to her about, you know, I'm going to pay that money back that I used to take out of your purse. And then, Meemaw, how can I make this up to you? I'm asking her, how can I make this up to you when you didn't know where I was? When you didn't know if I was alive or dead? And so one of the things she said was, Amanda, let me know when you get home. When you're traveling, let me know when you get home. Call me, let me know you're okay. So from that day on, I called my Meemaw every day of her life. And if I was traveling, I would call and let her know, Meemaw, I'm home. There was no phones, cell phones and all that text and stuff back then. We had landlines, you know. Yeah, found a phone book, that's right. I asked my kids one day to go look in the Yellow Pages, and they had no clue what I was talking about. So that's how I could do that, living amend to her, along with paying those financial amends. You know, I've had experiences where, and all my experiences were good. And what that did for me is it helped me rely on the God of my experience. You know, a lot of us come in here and say we trust God. Oh, I believe in God. I have a higher power. Yada, yada, yada. Okay, well, when it comes to putting that lip service into action, what does that look like? Am I really following through with what I'm being asked to do? Look, I've lost sponsees. Well, the two steps the most that I lose sponsees is 4 and 5. They've got a secret. They don't want to talk about it. Or 8 and 9, they don't want to make an amend. I had a woman I was working with, 15 years sober. All of a sudden, she stopped calling me. We had gotten to the 8th step. And there's a person still in her life today that she does not want to have to go sit down in front of. And she disappeared. That breaks my heart because it's such, for me, my experience was, it was such a eye-opening experience that, yes, I can rely on the God of my experience. Yes, if I do this deal, I'm going to have a relationship with my higher power that is unbelievable for me today. And don't think that I'm all that. I still have to make amends. You know, my husband will come in and maybe I've had a bad day and maybe I don't talk so sweet, kind, and loving to him. There are days when he walks in the door and he's breathing and I want to kill him. All based on my spiritual fitness. Obviously, I am not spiritually fit that day. I have to go to him. I have to call my sponsor. I have to say what's going on, do an immediate 10th step, 4th step, 5th step, work it all the way through, you know, and have to go to him. Honey, I am so sorry. But let me, you know, how can I make this up to you? I was wrong to do that. I certainly was wrong to do that in front of the children. This is what I'm willing to do, but what would you have me do to make up for that? I'll give you an example. The last time I traveled was a few months ago. And I called home. Now, look now. My husband is an earth person. He's not one of us. And I've got 2 teenagers. Y'all. I mean, So I call home. And he's telling me something that's going on. Well, immediately I go into, I guess you would call it critique mode. Okay. Because maybe he's not doing it the way that I would do it. Or maybe he's not doing it the right way, okay? And we have an agreement. When I am traveling, he does not call. When he calls me, it's all positive, okay? Because I'm trying to be with y'all. I'm trying to be a vessel for God. I can't handle all that. You grown, you handle it, right? So we have that agreement. But here I am reneging on that agreement because I'm not allowing him to be grown and handle it. I have put my 2 cents in, right? So when I got home from that weekend, we sat down and we talked about that. He sat me down and we talked about that. And I was totally not even aware of what I was doing. So I have a to-pack list, and it's a master list of any time I'm going, of things that I need to take. And so I added to that master list. Remember, when you call home, don't critique your husband. He is grown. Let him handle it. So Thursday night, when I called him, it was all sweet, kind, and loving. And I've got my list there, and I've already called my sponsor and prayed before I called him, right, to be sure. To be sure that I don't want to do that behavior. I don't want to do that to him. I don't want to emasculate him. He is a fine and wonderful man, and I'm married up, I promise you. I don't want to do that today. So I'm still, still in my life, you know. A lot of times I will not do a behavior to not have to make an amend. We had an issue recently, and I'm not going to go into a lot of it. I'm really praying to God about all that. But a grown man harmed my daughter. And when that was going on, I mean, I'm a country girl, and I'm always packing something, right? Okay? It's in my van right now. I've always got something. So when that was going down, one of the things that stopped me from walking to my car and harming this man was, ooh, but then I'm going to have to make an amend. And I'll be doggone. I am not going to have to make an amend. And so I'm on the phone with my sponsor, and I'm doing everything that I know how to do. And it's been a process. But sometimes that's what it takes for me to stop that behavior, is to just know I do not want to have to make an amend. Right? My son's birthday is in June, and the last 2 summers on his birthday, God bless him, he's got a summer birthday. You know, my mother's is June 15th, my husband is June 16th, and my son is June 17th. I will never forget, I was in labor with him on June 16th, and we were having my husband's birthday dinner, and I was in labor with my son, and my husband telling me, you better hold that baby in till after midnight. I want my own birthday, right? So God bless him for... And it's always Father's Day weekend, right? So God bless him. He's got a summer birthday, and it's hard. And his little boyfriends, you know, they're all gone, and they're traveling and stuff. And so a few months ago, before his birthday this year, we're coming back from the beach. My mother has retired to the beach, and it's down there in Destin, Florida, and it's gorgeous, and I love it. And so he and I we're by ourselves, and we have run to the store real quick, and he said, Mama, he said, you know, my birthdays always suck. I said, honey, what are you talking about? He's like, well, you make me stay on the beach, and my birthdays always suck. I'm like, baby, really? He's like, yes. Now, let me tell you this. I love the beach. Okay? There are people who like the beach. Those people will go down there, stay for a little bit, go back to the pool, go have dinner and all that. No. I love the beach. I am down there before sunrise. I'm walking up down the seashore, and I'm talking to the God of my experience, and I'm picking up seashells, and I've got my snacks for all day. I don't have to move. I'm under the umbrella all day. I've got me a book to read. I watch the sunset. I'm taking pictures. I'm posting it on Facebook. And then I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the stars come out. And then maybe I will go in. So the last two birthdays that my son had had, that's what had happened. And because I was the only adult there at the time, he had to stay there with me on the beach all day. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I said, Kip, oh, my God, honey. I said, look, I said, let me make this up to you. Let me make this right. You be thinking about how I can make that up to you. And when we get back to the house, I'm going to call my sponsor, right? So I get back to the house, and I'm bawling, and I'm calling my sponsor. How was I so, look, I'm still alcoholic. I'm still selfish. Oh, my God, my child, fruit of my loins, spawn of, you know. How could I have done that to him? So he thought about how I could make that up to him. And so today, his birthday was all about him and his little friend and what they wanted to do. And so what if I didn't go to the beach? The beach is not going anywhere. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I don't even know. I'm done. I do want to say, and it was mentioned, one of the speakers had mentioned about injure them or others and that you were not an other. I do have to say I do have some experience with that, especially in working with women. I do not ask my women who have been abused to sit before their abuser. That's not how we roll. I do not believe in putting that woman, that man, whoever, in harm's way. Okay. I also don't believe in wrecking marriages. You know, I'm also a recovering slut. And so, you know, thank you, brother. Thank you for identifying. Yeah. So, being a woman alcoholic, there are things that I did to get what I had to have on a daily basis, okay? So, and for most of my sobriety, I forgot a boy that I had lived with for 8 months. I mean, you know, and one day it came back to me. And so there have been some that I have found that I have been able to make face-to-face amends to. One of them's in my church. But there's some that I have found on Facebook or whatever, and it's not necessary. Excuse me, with my sponsor's guidance, I have not contacted them and said, hey, you know, one of them is happily married and got kids and lives in North Alabama. I'm not doing that. Okay. So I guess I say that. Be sure that you're prayerful about these amends and talk to your sponsors about them. I have never sat before anybody without talking to my sponsor about it first and without praying about it first, because I don't want to cause harm. I don't want to break up a marriage today. That boy probably don't even know who I am. Okay, good, good. And so then it is about how can I make that living amend today? I can be a sweet, kind, and loving wife. And the women in the rooms and the men in the rooms teach me how to be a sweet, kind, and loving wife, how to be a sweet, kind, and loving daughter, how to be a sweet, kind, and loving granddaughter, how to be a sweet, kind, and loving mother. And so let me be sure there was... Okay, that was it. All right. Thanks for letting me share.
fabulous start to the day, wasn't it? So we've got about 12 minutes till we're supposed to wind up because something else starts at 11:30. Oh, great. We got our first business. So if you guys can just line up, I'm not going to stand up here and have to call on you. And I guess you guys can sort of take turns. If you think like you might have some experience with what they're asking, jump up. All right.
Good morning, Steve Moore, alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
First of all, great job. A lot of wisdom shared this morning. I appreciate what you guys have to say. I would like to say to Amanda and Jerry, if one of you guys steal my watch, I deserve it. I'm okay with it. But guys I work with, this is a question that comes up. How do they make amends, or how do we make amends to people that have passed away that we've harmed? That's my question. And any of you can jump in and take it. Thanks.
Can I jump? I'll tell you how we do it in my lineage. And I had people that passed away, my great-grandmother. We write a letter. And now sometimes they want to take the letter to the graveside. Sometimes we do it in the house. I have found my experience, we put a picture of the person there, and I read the letter to that person. Okay. Whether that's at the graveside or at the house, so that I can feel that connection and feel that that's going to that person. And then what we do is we have a burning ceremony. And we tear up that letter and we burn it. And as that smoke is lifting, we know that it's going to our loved one, who I believe is right up there. So that's how we do it. So.
Marshall, alcoholic.
Hi.
You know, Bill Wilson said that most people are to some extent mentally ill. And I'm a shining example of multiple generations of alcoholism and mental illness. And I was supposed to be a joke. But but anyway, I made the terrible mistake with long-term sobriety of sending some emails out to my relatives and telling them exactly what I thought about their behavior over the years and how it had impacted me. And the blowback was horrific. But, I mean, absolutely horrific. But, so I imagine at some point I want to make amends, but part of me thinks, like, I should have told them that 30 years ago. Anyway, up to you guys.
That's one of y'all.
I would follow the guidance of a sponsor or somebody that has experience with that.
I just want to add in, it's going to be an interesting Thanksgiving.
One of the reasons that we do steps 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, obviously we've got to clear the slate. We've got to determine what our character defects are in 4 and 5. And in 8 and 9, we got to clean up the mess we made. That's very therapeutic in its own right. But another thing that comes from 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, in my experience, is we're developing a skill set. If I don't know how to do an inventory and I don't know how to make amends, there is no way in hell I can do step 10. Because step 10 takes the best part of 4 and 5 and the best part of 8 and 9 and puts them together. And it allows me to avoid wreckage of the future. Right? So if I've gone through steps 1 through 9, and I have cleaned up the mess I made, which is a rather lengthy process in my case, and I've cleaned all that up, the last thing I want to do is start screwing things up again, because that's going to require me to repeat that process. That's not a change. That's not a change. And so it's interesting in step 10 because it says, continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, not if we were wrong, when we were wrong, so Bill knew we ain't perfect. We're striving for spiritual perfection. Right? So when I make mistakes, when I make bad decisions, and I cause other people harm, it is inherent in step 10 that I go and I clean that up. Because otherwise, I got a mess in my life again, and it's going to start getting miserable. And when I get miserable enough, I drink. That's what I've always done. And so I think it's critical that we take the skills that we learn. I know how to do an inventory. I know what's wrong. I can find that out with my sponsor. Let me bring that in. Let me bring in the ability to make amends and go clean up the mess. Then I can get on with my life and be of service. Thanks.
Hey, y'all. We're real fortunate to have you here. Thanks for coming. We talk a lot about what can I do to make this right, and then shut up and listen and let people talk, right? How big a blank check do they have? Like, how far do I let them go with that? I haven't run into any situations personally where, oh no, I don't. With the sponsor's guidance, I have been able to discern. No, you don't do that. Or yeah, you need to do that, and we've worked it out every time. But what are the rules? Like, how do you? How much carte blanche do they have with that?
Yeah, great question. I think it's a case-by-case basis. Is this your greedy cousin asking, or is it the IRS? yeah, depends on who it is. The IRS gets the blank check, whatever they say. You can argue all you want, but it's not going anywhere. Or is it somebody who might have some other motives? And again, we got to have a sponsor. That's the point of a sponsor. Objectively look at it, you know, because I'll immediately say, you know, oven by myself, I'm looking for the shortest, easiest way out. An objective person would give me the more clear answer.
My name's Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. So I've got one amends that I'm sitting on. Because I'm still holding a lot of resentment towards this person, and they're not going away. I pray about it every day. And every time I think about going to make my amends to this person, it's just the resentments start coming up. They start coming up, and I know it's something that I definitely need to make right. So I'm kind of struggling with, like, at what point am I spiritually sound enough to go to this person and make my amends, and will that actually... Will going ahead and making those amends get me to a place where I let go of the resentments? Does that make sense a little bit?
You're spiritually ready when your sponsor says you are.
Yeah.
Sandy Beach says we either owe an amend or we have to ask forgiveness. How free do you want to be, honey?
Oh, yeah.
In the amends and the forgiveness, and I really want to, when we were talking, when whoever asked about how do you do with people who have passed, here's how I envision this. You know, I've got dark spots in my soul, okay? I've got dark spots in my soul. And when I'm doing the fourth step and the fifth step, the God of my experience is removing those dark spots. And when those dark spots come out, He is filling me with His light, okay? So every time I make an amend or I'm asking forgiveness, another dark spot leaves me, okay? I get what you're saying. I'm in a situation right now where I'm not exactly happy with somebody. I feel like they owe me an amend, and I'm having to practice forgiveness. Okay? It's causing me to work my program harder in that relationship than probably any other relationship in my life right now, which is giving me some more conscious contact. Here we go, God. We're about to peel another layer. Okay? So much so that I just cut my hair and changed the color and everything 3 days ago. Okay? literally. Yeah. This is what going through the steps will do for you, people. If you were mine, okay, we would be working. Why do you still have the resentment? Why have you not already let that go? Okay? If you were mine, we'd have already taken care of that, because that's first. You're obviously powerless over whoever it is that's making your life unmanageable. Do you believe a God of your experience can restore you to sanity? Okay, are you putting that person in the third step prayer? God, I offer Susie to thee, to build with her and do with her as I will. Leave her the bond yourself that she may better do thy will. Take away her difficulties that she may bear witness to those that she would help of thy love, thy power, and the way of life. Are you putting them in the third step prayer every time they come to your mind? Okay, let's look at the fourth step. Let's look at where all is she? And every little instant, we would work that out. And we would go through there. And you would share that with me verbally, and that's your fifth step. And then we're looking at the character defects that this situation is bringing out in you. How is it manifesting? Is it causing you to lose sleep? Is it causing you to be ugly? Is it causing you to be a little meek, 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 meek? Is it causing you to eat the whole bag of Oreos? Is it? I mean, we'll go through that, okay? Right. How are your character defects manifesting? How are they showing up in your life? Do you owe anybody an amends during this situation? Has it caused you to be so out of sorts that you have caused harm to somebody? Do you owe an amends? Well, let's make that amends. Tenth step. You're doing the tenth step. We're going through this. You're seeing where it's causing all these issues. 11th step is going to cause you to be closer to the God of your experience. You're seeking. You're asking for help. You're praying through all of this. 12th step, you're going to be able to share this with somebody who has the same experience, probably in a meeting in the next week. So that would be the first thing, if you were mine, that we would get to. Because when I am in front of somebody having to make an amend, I have to be in a place ready to hear what it is they have to say. I have to be in a place where I am okay with all the work that I've done, that it doesn't matter what they say, because that's what I've been taught to do. I have to sit there and shut up and listen and receive and know that the God of my experience is with me in that moment, protecting me and being with me, and that I'm going to be okay no matter what they say. So when you said all that, what I heard was you have put this person up here. Okay, and when I put somebody up here, that's blocking me from my spirit. That's blocking me from my Creator. Yeah. And if that's happening, then I'm not getting all that I need to get from my Creator. Does any of that make sense? Awesome. And thank you so much for sharing that at the microphone. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask Amanda to be my sponsor.
Reach it, sister. Yeah. I'm so sorry that we couldn't get to the last question. We do need to close because the next workshop is at 12:30. I would say anybody that has another amends question, the moderators will be here all weekend. We're so lucky to have them here. Please keep in mind that our next workshop is from 11:30 to 12:30. The Area 16 officers from Macon will be doing a workshop on what giving in service gave to me. And then there is some part of the Al-Anon program, but back in this room at 3:30 will be the next workshop with this wonderful AA panel on the spiritual malady. So let's give them a round of applause. And let's close the Lord's Prayer.